I'm going to take a few minutes and do some Q&A and see what's what with you and if there's anything I can do to be more helpful. So, any questions about what I was suggesting you practice this morning, what I said this morning, but how you were practicing and what came up, and anything you want me to explain more or clarify or suggest, take a few minutes. Yeah. Right. What's your name? That's right. Hi, Ros. Thank you. I'll repeat it just for to make sure I have it right and for other people. So if your attention is on some aspect of a sensation that's in your body, and as you observe it, after some time it disappears, then is it best to stay there and notice that it's no longer there, or is it best to go to some other thing? So thank you for asking. There, first of all, in principle, there is no right or wrong, or even best or worst way of meditating. So because it's an art, and you're developing, an art, what we want, though, is what's best. Well, what we want is to be present, to be in the present moment, to be mindful, to be in the present moment, experiencing whatever it is we they're choosing to notice, knowingly. We know that we're there and we're noticing whatever it may be, sensations. If when a sensation that you were noticing disappears, because sensation things change and come and go, then if you're present, you can stay and be there without it being there as long as you're staying present. But if you are using that sensation to help you be present and now you don't have anything, it's like you're climbing a mountain and it's a rope that you're holding and you don't have one, then you might not be present. You might just go drifting away, in which case you won't be developing present awareness. So then it's not so. Then you want to switch to something else that is also present that you can now anchor your attention in the present with. If, for instance, you're noticing what goes on in the body when you're criticizing yourself, as an example, that sort of like, oh, come on, Heather thing that I used to do a lot, then it's possible to feel that tight, clenchy, oppression feeling. And it's possible to be noticing that and then to have that relax because it's seen as being ridiculous. And it's not even true that I'm not that bad. And so the whole associated pattern can dissolve, including the pressure of doing that. And to stay present in a body that isn't doing that is very useful because it will teach you that that clutchy, pressury thing is painful, is a struggle. And the absence of the struggle feels free comparatively. So to actually know and recognize and experience some moments of that freedom really reveals how tense and struggly and costly that clutching is. So you'll learn a lot from that, providing, of course, you are present and you can feel that coming and going of dukkha, in that case, pressure. If you're simply observing an itch or a pain in the knee as an anchor to stay present and it's no longer painful, depending on the quality of your being able to be present, you may need something a little more intense to help you there, because you might just go, oh, okay, shopping. It just depends on what goes on in your mind. There's no right or wrong. Is that useful? Oh, yes. You can actually feel it. Yes. Actually, the pain is what's fighting with it. Yeah. So I have a question. What's your name?
Jane.
Jane. Jenny?
Jane.
Jane. J.
I like Janie.
But it's all good. Okay, it's Jane. So Jane, when you my question is, when you're able to get in touch with that spacious, lighter, non-struggly feeling of wonder, open or however it is for you, and then your attention is drawn back to the pain in your back, Are you relating to the pain in your back with a little more ease after you've been spacious? Or can you notice how that then when you go to the pain in your back, your attitude is different because it's like, oh no. Can you see your attitude? Not just the sense of awe and the sense of pain, but the attitude of openness and the attitude of resistance. Can you see that?
Yes, I can.
Because that's what's more important than whether there's pain or not pain. Because, and I'm saying this to everybody, of course, is that it's possible to have pain and not suffer. Because if our attitude is one of spaciousness and empathy and tenderness, you know, compassion, which means basically not getting triggered into any negative anything and just, oh, this too, okay, you know, allowing, then we aren't struggling. You're having pain, but you're not adding struggle on top of the pain. So you can use that awe experience, that wonder, that where your heart is lighter and softer and tender. And then you can play and let the pain of the back be there too, and held in this more relaxed, spacious softness of heart. And you'll discover that the pain is a smaller thing than a pain plus resistance, which is war. You know, so you can actually then be with difficulty without it having to proliferate into negativity. It's very, very educational. It's also liberating. And the liberation of the Buddha that comes through our practice is not the liberation of pain, because we can't control that, or loss, or, you know, whatever it is, heartache. But we can be liberated from adding resistance to it. But until you watch your mind not resisting, resisting, not resisting, resisting, you have no control over that reaction. So you use the experience, and then from the experience you learn about what's going on in your mind, in your attitude. Because that you can do something about. You cannot do anything about whether or not you're in pain. Whether or not, you know, you've had illness or difficulty in your life has befallen you. We're not in control of most of it, but we are able to choose our response once we are able to observe it. But you have to be able to see it. So you take that and from that observe your attitude, if you like, your mental response to whatever it is. No pain, pain. Yeah, you understood me. Yeah, yeah, that's the value. It's not in that you can sit here still and have a back that hurts and feel awe and not. It's so that you can use that in more graciously coping with all of the ups and downs that we're inevitably going to have. You know, when the ups go away, what a disappointment that is. Unless we go, they're always going to go away, and the new ones will come. And then our attitude is one of accommodation and surrender, instead of I like, I don't like, I don't want, greed, hatred, delusion, which equals struggle, which equals suffering. And instead, it's like, oh, this is beautiful, up we go. Oh, this is over. Oh, I knew it was going to go. Oh, this is horrible. This is pain. This is part of being human. Oh, this is going to pass. Oh, this is a boring day. Oh, that's what it's like sometimes. If the attitude can be, oh, I see, we are at peace with the ups and downs, instead of I need the good, I hate the bad, and I'm bored to death with all the boring stuff, which is not the way to live a full life. You know, it's the way to live a superficial life at the mercy of changing circumstance. And we don't need to be at the mercy of anything. We can be masters of our unfolding with ease. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So great, great to have, actually. We learn a lot by having pain. Ajahn Sumedho, one of the senior Western monks, who's retired now, he's in his 80s, was the first Thai forest Westerner to be given a monastery to run in England. And when it was still relatively new, when it was very new, it was very difficult. It was in poor condition. It was a house that somebody donated. It was cold and drafty and leaky roofs and difficult. And a lot of struggle, and the people in England had no idea about monks and how to support them, and the whole thing was a big struggle, and there was conflict between them all because it was also stressful. And then they began to get it together, and it began to work, and they began to be understood by their communities, and people began to go and support them, and it actually started to get quite flowy. And so Ajahn Sumedho was on a visit back to Thailand to the senior monk who had given him the authority in the first place, Ajahn Chah. And he was saying, you know, actually things are going really quite well. This is working, this is working, this is working. We're all getting along. And Ajahn Chah says, well, you're not going to learn very much from that lot, are you? So we don't just want the heavenly realms. The Buddha said that the best place for awakening, the best realm, meaning basically condition that we're in, is the one that we're in as a human. Because if you're in heavenly realms, i.e., everything's groovy and you have tons of money and all the options you want and great health and everybody's loving around you, you know, good luck with it, but then you actually won't wake up because you're just going to drift. You'll just dream and go to sleep and oh la la. And if you're in the hell realms or the animal realms, meaning, you know, you're in Syria or you're in, you know, a family of, you know, alcoholic negativity or whatever it is, you're desperate in some way, your whole focus is on survival, and they're not luxury enough to have a moment to reflect, you know, to understand, to have compassion. You're just guarded or whatever it is, and so you can't wake up. There's not the opportunity to actually have some of that space. But in between is the human realm, where it goes up and it goes down and it goes off to the side, and you have enough pleasure and you have enough conflict and you have enough intelligence that actually it's possible to learn how to navigate this with skill. So don't want no pain. Don't want all pleasure. You'll go to sleep. Other questions? They're useful for everybody, and I like teaching from questions, and I don't have to think about what to say here. Hi, your name?
Karen.
Yeah. Giving. Yes. It's a different thing, isn't it? And we want to give. We can give. Yes. And then it makes the actual giving of your attention more conscious. Because otherwise it almost can feel like an obligation. Pay attention. Yes, 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 yes. Earning. Yeah. Good. You're welcome. Do you have a question? Okay, fine. Okay, fine. Okay, fine. How about your experience this morning of watching your thoughts and naming when you had a whole thought attack and being able to feel that in your body? Anybody have those experiences this morning? Yeah? And did you find yourself able to tolerate your thinking attack without getting so attacked by it? Anybody explain any of that? I like to know that it's actually working. You know, it's not so much fun sitting here teaching things and then having no idea what happened. Please.
Uh-huh. After naming the kind
right. Yes. That's interesting, and it can be embarrassing. and it can be frustrating because it's like, oh, yeah. And we have tendencies. We have, you know, ways. We have judgy ways or critical ways or, you know, nervous ways, or planning is a big habit, or, you know, things like that. So you get to see, oh, this whole style. You realize it's not all the little details which seem to be, but they're all this. It's the same thing. It's all worrying or something like that. Planners, for those planners here, are there any planners here? Planning. If you stay with the general energy of planning, it's that you don't trust. You're not trusting that the next moment will unfold in some way that you can handle, so you better get it together to make sure it's going to be a certain way. And that's a lack of being able to just trust yourself, your mind, your ability, your heart to respond. What will happen will be manageable. It's fear. And fear is the most basic sensation emotion that we all have. It's how we've survived thus far, you know. So it's a totally legitimate feeling, but it's interesting to realize, oh, that's what it is. And if there's a lot of, and you feel that you're planning neurotically, which probably all planning is neurotic to some degree, but if it's really intense, then you might want to explore the territory of trusting and doubting and trusting and doubting, and see where do you find trust and what that's like. And then when it's not there, and then there's this doubting and worrying and planning again, and what that's like, and get to understand the difference in them. Because worrying and, you know, and planning, whatever it may be, is exhausting. All of these negative emotions, not the bad emotions, but struggling emotions, difficult emotions, are costly energetically. And a lot of them aren't necessary. They're sort of, we think they're necessary, but it's a story we're telling. So if you can allow yourself to feel the difficult emotional state, whatever it is, even a little bit, you begin to realize it's doable. And I can actually be worried, and I can be sad, or I can be like I was, that story I told, PO'd. I can actually tolerate it. In fact, I can learn from it. That's why we can wake up when it's difficult. So difficulty isn't a problem to avoid or fix or not have or to suppress. It's actually where we understand a lot about how that then motivates our behavior and how useful is that behavior actually. Not that we're trying to do a bunch of psychoanalysis here, but by just simply being with the direct experience. This is the key. You want to be with the direct experience, but whatever that is, including a heavy feeling in the heart, you know, or a tightness of breath, or a dread, whatever that is. And let me be with this experience directly. And the kind of understanding that we get isn't a thought process. It's not a figuring out. It's go, oh. So when I had that thought popped up, it's like, he couldn't see me. I didn't figure that out. I didn't take a lot of time mentally going through, you know, thought after thought after thought. I just was feeling not seen. First angry, and then hurt, and then not seen. That's really it. The more I just stayed with it, I suddenly felt like a little one again, not seen. And then out of that, I was like, he didn't see me. That's why I feel this way. Then it's like, he couldn't see you. All right. So it all unwound, but not through a mental figuring, not through a thinking process, but a being with a direct experience. Insight. That's what insight is. That's exactly what it is. It's like realization. I love that word, a realization, and it dawns, and you don't do it. You don't do it. The ego can't do it. It's not a process that you can figure out. And the more we have insights, and they can be little momentary, and they accumulate, and they develop in us a sense of trusting that our wisdom works, and our understanding will understand in its own way, not because we're clever enough to figure it out, but because when we're present enough and quiet enough, wisdom shows us, the lights come on, different things. And so we begin to relax more, and there's more trusting in general, and therefore there's less planning, less shopping, less addictions, less blame, all of it, because we're not trying to make it better. We can, it's okay as it is, even when it's always going to go up and down. Hello. Your name?
Ashley.
Hi, Ashley. Stress?
Trust.
To trust, I think so. It's not trust.
Yeah, so what might analysis be attached to
as well? Analysis, similar. Yeah, wanting to get rid of something or wanting to figure something out, thinking that you... The thing is, we, with analysis, any kind of thinking, we believe in it. We think that that is going to be helpful. That's why we do so much of it. We think that planning will be helpful. That's why we do so much of it. Whatever. Rehearsing will actually prepare us for that conversation. We will do a better job if we're prepared, and therefore we rehearse. It's all from not trusting that I can meet the next moment appropriately and I don't have to worry. It'll be whatever it will be, and I will function well, and it will unfold. And so it's a huge, huge area of trouble is the whole thing of lack of trust. In fact, the way the Buddha taught them, the Buddha taught five hindrances, which you may or may not know about, but five sort of the umbrella states that we get into that are in the way, when I was talking about cluttering up our beautiful moments, you know, when we're having a sunset moment and there's peace and there's acceptance and there's expansiveness and delight and no stress. And then we get cluttered up by the sense of me and I need this. And so the Buddha described these five states under which all the complex junk that we have fall. First one is that we're wanting something other than what's here. So it's like, oh, if only, and I've got to own, how can I? And it's opposite, which is wanting it not to be this way, resisting what's here, back pain in Jane's case, or whatever it may be, heartache, or fear of the of tomorrow because I haven't planned it. It's all resisting negativity, ill will, or anxiety, etc. Then there are another pair. That's one and two. Three and four are opposites again. One is a state of being sinking. I like that word, sinking. It's kind of like, ugh. It's dull. It's like disconnected. It's no energy. Depression is in this area. I just can't be bothered to go and do something is in this area. Sort of dullness. Sleepiness. The classic word is sloth and torpor. And we don't use those very much. They sound great. I love saying them, sloth and torpor. If you've ever seen a sloth, they move extremely slowly. And torpor is like thick, gooey water that doesn't move very much. It's really sludgy. So any state that you experience that's that kind of like, it's not the opposite of vital, alive. And then its opposite, which is agitated, worried, full of remorse, regret, can't sit still, squirmy, can't stand this, you know, the agitated state. And then the fifth state, not in order of preference, just is doubt. And doubt is all those things where there is no trust. And it's the biggest. And it's with along with all the other ones. Because if you're totally content with what you have, it's enough. And you don't have to have something else. But if it's not enough, I don't trust that this will do it. This will serve me. This is enough for my life. I need different, more. If something unpleasant is happening to us, like back pain, I'll use that as an example, and I think that that's not okay, and I can't handle this in my life. There's resistance. It's that I can't relax and just trust that here I am, living my life, it's fine, and they happen to have back pain with it. There's an element of doubt in there, of the worthiness of my life, or this being good enough, or something. With agitation, it's like we definitely can't stand being here. We feel guilty or uncomfortable in whatever way. It's like I cannot trust this moment, so I've got to do anything and get anywhere else and do anything about it. This is impossible to settle with. There's no trusting it. I don't know about the sludgy one. Maybe there's less doubt in that one. Yeah. So it's an interesting one to explore. I spent about a year paying attention to my experience of doubt. And when it showed up, and what it was like, and what helped it dissipate. It was a whole year. Like, I just really decided to make that a focus for myself a long time ago now. It was fascinating. I thought, it's everywhere. It's the reason for me showing up. If this moment is one of those moon moments, it's perfect. I totally trust that moment. There is no need for me to do anything. As soon as I go, I better take a photograph. Then it's not enough. I don't trust that moment to be sufficient, full enough, and I have to now do something about even capturing it on a screen, and then it'll be enough. Even then, it's like I saw that the cause of the sense of self to come up and do anything stressful was doubt. Huge, huge. It's very interesting. And the lack of it, when there's no separate sense of me having to, I need, I want, I hate, I can't. When there's trust, when there's trusting the unfolding of life, I am just there with this unfolding. There's no self-concern. It's interesting. Does that answer your question? I got carried away with the answer because I love that topic. Yes, hi. Well, I can't be in your mind and tell you what you're doing in there. So you'll be doing all of it, probably. At times you'll be going like, okay, let me just feel that. And then like, oh my God, God, I can't stand this. I was like, okay, I can just be this. Like, so it'll be shifty. If the bottom line is, can you stay mindful? You need to know what that means, what that is, centered with access to, it's like two minds, I always think. I learned from that Uteshaniya teacher, he described it as mindfulness is like two minds in operation. Mostly we have our front mind, if you like, our neocortex, our left hemisphere, commenting, recognizing, explaining, planning, all of that. But there's this other mind in the back, watching over it all, going like, uh-huh, worrying, happening again, okay. And that ultimately is not good or bad. It's kind, benign, quiet, knowing. Always stable. Whereas this one is neurotic, jumping up and down like a little kid. This is like grandma kind of in the background. And so if you can have access to grandma while you're watching the like, it's okay, no, it's not okay, it's okay, it's okay, then that's okay. But if when you get into the like, okay, oh, this is so sad, and then it's like, oh, and you lose grandma-ness, then that's not skillful. It's not wrong, but it's not mindfulness. And so be wary of... And you often don't know you've lost it until afterwards, and you realize, oh, I really lost it then, you know. And now here I am again realizing that. And so the losing of mindfulness isn't even a problem, because as long as we're learning what that is, when we've lost it and when we're more present again, we're getting to know. And the more we are familiar with being present and aware with this overview kind of mindfulness knowing thing there, the more we will want it, because we know when grandma's there, I can actually have some choice over my mind and therefore my life and therefore everything I say. And when she's gone, I'm just a little kid who's just totally triggered by somebody's mean to me and I'll shout or something. And that's not actually the way I want to live my life. And so watching it coming and going, by simply observing, you learn and your choices keep growing and you become wiser. What people a lot don't understand is they hear the Dharma, they recognize certain things, they have certain insights, and then believe that I have to try and be better, or I have to try and be mindful. I have to try and do something. That's too much. Doesn't even work. It's frustrating. All we have to do is keep watching. If we keep present and we keep watching, we will see, as I was saying to you, Jay, when I was talking about there's your pain, watch yourself when you're with your state of awe or that openness and watch what happens. There's the pain again. If you keep watching your inner experience, you'll learn from it. You can't not. So the only effort is to keep your eyes open, as it were, your inner eyes open with the process of coming and going and being neurotic and being wise and all of that. You can't make yourself do it well. That's giving a standard that's false, and then you'll just get frustrated. So don't expect anything, but keep watching. Does that make sense? Grandma just came out of my mouth because I'm just a new grandma. For the second time. But. Yes. Hi. Your name? Hi, Steve. Yes. Trump is going to be impeached. Yes, yes, yes.
Say in my personal life, like with my spouse, we're having some issues, like, well, I hope that.
Yes. It's a great question, Steve. It's a really important question. Sorry?
Eve.
Y-V-E-S. Oh, Eve, excuse me. Absolutely. Thank you. I have my hearing aids in, but still. It's not great acoustics, but anyway. So, yes, Eve was. Did you. Anybody not hear Eve? So Eve was asking about what about hope and the positive of hope, you know, the well-wishing, the good intention, wanting things to work well or be better, impeach Donald Trump tomorrow, for instance, or what about the unwholesomeness of that, you know, being caught in wanting anything and wanting what isn't and so on. And so it's a very important question. So it's like wanting itself, hoping itself isn't necessarily a good or bad thing. The hindrance of desire, of wanting, is only a hindrance sometimes, and other times it's not. And when it's hindering our awakened state, our beautiful, rich, wholesome states, it's a hindrance. But when it isn't impeding that, it isn't. And so I want to be happy isn't a hindrance. But I want my happiness to come from that particular source, and if I don't get that thing, then I'm not happy. That's a hindrance, because I'm removed from what is. So it's when wanting isn't ahead of itself, already at its goal, grasping its goal, but just leaning towards something. It's a motivator. And so hoping for peaceful relationship when you're struggling with your spouse is intention, it's orientation, it's aiming, but it isn't going to the end and getting the thing you want to work, because it may or may not, because that's bigger than you can possibly do. You have no idea. There's so many other factors coming in, including her own independent factors coming in, that you can't control, but you can at least aim your intentions in honesty or care or truthfulness or so on. Do the best you can and still not know what will happen and be okay with whatever that may be. And so if we do and say and even think what we do motivated by good wishes, good intentions, we are wishing something, but we're not attached that that works. Because the work part is having it work is playing God, I call that, where we're ahead of ourselves. But if we don't want to be not aiming at all and just sit back, oh well, whatever, you know, life sucks and then you die, why bother to get up in the morning, you know, then there's no guidance, there's no kind of thrust. But to have a thrust without getting to the end and getting attached to the result is too far. So you don't want too little and no intention at all, but you don't want so much that you get frustrated when it doesn't work. So beware of the word work. So activists do what, you know, an activist will be active about something or saying something because you really want something to happen. But still, if you see my hand, if I can do it like this, and whatever's going to, in the end, happen, what's going to unfold is way bigger than me. I'm doing it with this sort of giving. But if I'm doing it, you better make this, you know, you better be happy now, you know, or wanting this to work. Then I'm kind of trapping in the future into my agenda, and it's hindering the life, if you like, for unfolding. There isn't any trusting. So it's how closely you attach to what isn't yet here. So that's a very fine thing, to be really motivated by something you really believe or you really want without expectation. So yeah, because you know, usually if I don't expect anything, then I won't, why bother? So this is bother, really bother, because you really care, and whatever may happen still is beyond me. And that's how we do the best we can do. But it's the best, it's not like, oh, well, I did the best I could. It's kind of in a given up sort of way. It's like, really, I'm going to do the best I can do. And still, my hands are open, because still this is bigger than me, and I still don't know. But I'm going to give it all I've got, you know. Does that help you? It's very fine. And it's not like that's absolute. It's like in a moment, as I was just saying over here to, I can't remember your name, already standing up on the back wall.
Jess.
In a moment, it's wholesome. And the next moment, it's like, oh, I really want this. And the next moment, it's like, whatever, I'm still going to do it. The next moment, oh, I hope she does. Because the mind is like it's going to keep shifting.
Yeah,
so
because the way you explain it, it makes so much sense. It's just the actual, like right now, you know, I get it.
Yeah, in another moment, oops, you tilted a little too far forward. Yeah, and so we see, and so our practice is actually to keep watching. When I got a little too far ahead of myself and I got a little tight, and then there was disappointment or frustration or blame, let's say, it's like, oh, I got attached that. Okay, so I'm gonna not put any of the expectation on you. I'm just going to say, this would be great if. And leave all the space in the world for whatever to happen. And then we do it well, and then we don't do it well, and then we do it well, and we learn all the time.
Life's practice.
Practice. Life is practice. Nice question. Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Can you say a little bit more about whether it's important to sort of differentiate between whether it's a thought or an emotion?
No. It doesn't matter. Okay. You can get too busy trying to get it right or get the right word, or you know you're in an emotional knot, but you don't know whether it's hurt or whether it's shame or where does the line. You don't have to get that hung up. That you're just using those ways to help you be present, honest, open with your experience. Some people's minds are really wordy, and they can really get very good descriptions very easily. And some people, it's a big blur in there, and their emotion, but they couldn't tell you exactly. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be that kind of person. But if it's helping you be present, and with grandma, you know, knowing what's happening and just being quiet enough to go, this is interesting, this is tricky. We don't even have the words to say that. You're just like, that's fine. Words aren't the thing. Present experience is the thing. Yeah. Good. Okay. Maybe that's enough chit-chat. Where's the clock? Yes, that's enough. So I'll, for the next 15 minutes, we'll do a little meditation, and I'll give you a few words of description and guidance as we do it, a guided meditation, and then we'll do some walking, because I know everyone gets sleepy after lunch. I do, I'm sure everybody is just like me. So we're going to use our imaginations a little bit here to begin with, especially. I'd like you to imagine yourself in the company of a good friend of yours. Just any friend who's, you're really comfortable and relaxed when you're with this person. Maybe it's a long-term friend. And imagine yourself in his or her company. And for some of you, you can imagine the setting. Some of your imaginations are more colorful than others, or you might imagine what they look like, their expression on their face. Maybe even you've got clothing that you imagine, or what their hairstyle is, or something. Whatever it takes for you to be able to have a really reasonably clear image of being with this person. Sound of their voice might include memory of things you've done or places you've been. Don't have to get busy with trying to remember things, but you want to be able to feel as though you're with them now. And then tune in to what it is like when you're hanging out with this person who you know quite well and who you like, and it's easy to be with them. There's a few qualities or aspects of being in their presence which are there, and there's a few things which are absent when you're with somebody who you like, who's a friend, a trusted friend. Familiar, comfy. Usually we're relaxed. We're not usually tense and defended or guarded. We're usually at ease. Feel that sense of being at ease, relaxed. We're usually not tilted forward trying to convince them of something, or tilted back feeling guarded and defensed or wincing. We're just present and grounded and at ease. See if you can feel that. And now imagine that this one, this dear friend of yours, is talking to you and has a whole lot of something to say, to describe. Maybe they're going through something in their life, or something's happened, or they've had some kind of news that impacts them a lot, or something. And they're talking, and you're listening. And it's turning out that your role in this particular conversation is witnessing, receiving, while they unburden themselves or reveal whatever it is, processing something with you. And feel into your role, because you care for this person, you're their friend, that you have room for them in you, in your mind, in your heart. You can really give them your full, undivided, quiet attention. That you're not needing to stop them or hurry them. You're not judging them, whatever's going on. You're not bored by them and you're twitching away on your cell phone at the same time. You're actually fully there. That you can feel what they feel. You can have empathy for them and resonate with them. You have time and space and you also have care for them and what they're going through. There's a warmth and a care, caring. Can you remember that you know this feeling? You've felt like this before, you've done this. You're not coming forward into their space, interrupting or fixing or criticizing or recommending or teaching. You're not falling away from them in disinterest or uncaring. You're fully, quietly, open, present with your friend. I call this passive friendliness. You're not exactly doing anything, but you're being fully here. And it's very satisfying for both of you, because you're really present, connecting. Now I'd like you to put the shoe on the other foot, as it were, and imagine yourself in exactly the same setting with the same person, but you're the one who's doing the talking and your friend is the one who's the witness. And you're revealing whatever you're revealing or processing or explaining or unburdening yourself, and they're holding you with their kind attention. And getting in touch, if you can, with what it's like to be seen and held and cared for and empathized with in this friendly way, without being interrupted or corrected or judged or abandoned. Tuning into the quality of passive friendliness that's being surrounding you, and what that feels like. We feel we're precious, that we're okay, valued, cared for. Connected, belonging. Validated. And see if you can realize or get in touch with the power of that. It seems to be very little is actually being done. But what importance it is to be seen fully, quietly, witnessed clearly. To know we're worthy of someone's full attention, deep. Gaze. It's one of the most healing, loving experiences we have as humans. Passive friendliness. Respectful, spacious. And it's not intense, it's easy, it's natural. So, remembering the value of this, and see if you can encourage for yourself to keep in touch with this quality of friendliness that's quiet, relaxed, open, present, tender. In as many moments as possible, in whatever meetings you may have, whatever connections, relationships, long-term or momentary. See if you can encourage yourself in some way to keep on offering such simple, powerful friendliness. And then lastly, continuing with the same intention, but include that you can be friendly in this way with and to yourself, your own little mind that gets frantic sometimes, your own neurotic habits, your own woundedness, your own aches and pains. As as well as anyone and everyone else who may come across your horizon. This is not dependent on anything or anyone, simply a way of being. Most helpful. Regardless of circumstance. It's simple, it's easy, and it's natural. It's very habituated for us to judge, to compare, to wish to be different, to regret, to criticize and complain. We've done that so much that even though this is easy and simple and natural, it's not a habit a lot of the time. So I encourage you to practice passive friendliness when it's easy, frequently, so that it may become a new habit, a new pathway that you can grow in your brain, so that it's there easily and often, even in difficult times. So please carry on, being in your contact with your grandmother, aware of the thinking when it gets louder or when it gets softer, staying embodied. Do some walking meditation now. We'll take 35 minutes for walking. Lise, you're going to ring bell this afternoon? Okay, so if you would ring the bell, 6 or 7 minutes before 3, we'll all come back at 3, and up to 10 of you, if you would like to have some more personal questions answered, come and meet me now in the theater. Okay. Otherwise, carry on with your walking. Do you all know, I haven't given you any instructions about walking meditation, because you all put your hands up. No one put their hands up. You'd all meditated before. You okay with your walking? Anybody need any instructions? Put your hand up this moment. Okay, good. Please come and see me for just a second, then the rest of you carry on.